This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of September. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier. Here's what we got for you this week. Why do so many Austin High School grads who intend to go to college not make it there?
Like, my life depends on a decision that I make, and I have no parent guidance to it. It makes me feel kind of alone.
In the land of the oil bust, the repo business booms.
You have a nice truck and you have a nice home, and you have to start downgrading, letting things go.
And what this year's grape harvest means for Texas wines.
What's making people happy this year in terms of winemakers and grape growers is that the white grapes have come back.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast if you have not already, weekend.kut.org. We have links there to iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, RSS. Leave us a review in the iTunes store if you have the time to do it. If you have any questions or if there's another way that you would like to consume this podcast that we're not doing for you, let me know at KUT Nathan on Twitter or nathan@kut.org. So first of all, I want to tell you, the city of Austin passed its budget for the new fiscal year, which starts October 1st. Council members okayed this budget with 8 hours to go before their deadline of midnight. And the mayor and Councilmember Ora Houston had some final comments before they broke into a standing ovation from the dais.
I think we were kind of making up the process as we went along, and I'm proud of the process that we went through. So I think it was reasoned and deliberate, but no question, but that we can make it better.
And Mayor, I'd like to say that if it's not inappropriate, let's give the city manager and all the staff a hand.
Absolutely.
Something to note about this budget, if you own a home or even if you rent a home, and that is that council approved using $1 million to lower the tax rate. It translates to about $2 a year if you own a median priced home in Austin. This is a story that I was kind of excited about this week. I'm not going to lie. AT&T has finally caught up with its competitors and is offering what it calls high definition calling in Austin. The audio quality on this, it's better than a landline. It's not quite as good as FaceTime or Skype, though. And you have to have a relatively new phone. You have to have an iPhone 6 or like a Samsung Galaxy S5. And you have to be calling someone else on AT&T. But if you do all those things, there's no extra cost for this service. It sounds a lot better. Clark Bird is a technical consulting engineer with AT&T.
The biggest thing that customers will note when they're on an HD voice or voice over LTE call is reduced background noise. The audio quality is spread out over a wider frequency band, and that allows us to cram more speech in there, make it sound less digital.
If you're on T-Mobile or Verizon, this is all old technology to you. They've had this service for more than a year in Austin. Many of the giant green cypress trees along the Blanco River, beautiful trees, destroyed by the flooding last Memorial Day weekend. And as KUT's Veronica Zaragovia reports, Hays County is now in the process of considering proposals to help with reforestation.
Austin-based Tree Folks is one of the groups that wants to be involved in the reforestation along the Blanco River. Thais Perkins, its director, says the work is plenty for nonprofits, Hays County, and agencies like the Texas A&M Forest Service.
The entire riparian forest was removed, so not just the stately cypress people are used to seeing along the river, but all of the trees behind it.
That means the river's banks have lost their ability to slow down future floods.
It also means that stormwater filtering as it flows into the river is compromised, and that is about 80 miles of habitat for animals, wildlife of Central Texas up and down the river that's also been removed.
Now experts need to get a hold of enough seeds. Rachel Ramft is with the Northern Hill Country River Project.
Seed collection happens in the fall. That's when the trees are seeding out. And last fall, we had no idea that we would have this much demand for seedlings.
Ramft says trees should be replanted in different stages so they don't repeat the problem of having trees of the same age all along the river. She also says grasses and shrubs need to be planted to hold the riverbanks together during floods. And during droughts, this would also help keep water in the river. Veronica Zaragovia, KUT News.
A lot of high school graduates in Central Texas enroll directly into college, but almost half of them don't start college in the fall. It happens across the country. It's a phenomenon that's sometimes called the summer melt. A lot of these students whose college plans get derailed, they're the first in their families even to think about getting a college degree, and most of them come from low-income families. So we wanted to get a better idea of why this happens. KUT's Kate McGee spent the summer tracking three students after they graduated from high school and prepared for college, called this project The Months Between. Here's the story of Erica Carbajal Ramos.
It's the last weekend in August, and it's freshman move-in day at Our Lady of the Lake University in San Antonio.
Erica.
Erica Carbajal Ramos has just arrived. She's standing in front of a long table. Behind it sit a row of college-age students. They're helping freshmen sign in.
Albert, did you look for his ID?
J-A-L?
Matthew
Tobar. The meeting hall is loud and hectic and confusing.
Do you have your actual ID?
What's your name?
Matthew Tobar.
My room number? 212.
Flores.
Erica looks overwhelmed.
A lot of Erica, so
it's fine.
They're going to go ahead and give you your key down there, and your room's Flores 126.
And just head over to IT. As soon as possible, so you can take your picture and get your ID.
Erica hasn't taken her ID photo yet because she only officially decided to go to Our Lady of the Lake a few weeks ago. To understand why, let's rewind a few months to late June.
Hi, my name is Erica Carbajal. I just graduated from the Anna Church School for Young Women Leaders. Right now, it seems like I am enrolled at ACC, Austin Community College, but my dream school is Our Lady of the Lake University in San Antonio. Yeah, I'm kind of caught in a situation there.
When Erica was first accepted at Our Lady of the Lake, her financial aid package wasn't large enough, and she couldn't afford to make up the difference. She enrolled at Austin Community College as a backup while she figured things out. By graduation in June, most of her classmates already picked their college.
I'll get on Facebook, and I'll see all my friends, and they're uploading pictures from their orientation. Like, they're already making that connection to students who they're going to be in class with. And I'm still at home, and I still don't know what school I'm going to, and these students are already buying their school gear.
As the first in her family to even graduate high school, Erica had to navigate the path to college without her parents' help. They told Erica to find other ways to pay without taking out student loans.
That was mostly the financial aid talk with my family, like just apply to scholarships and do scholarships and find money. But how do you find money?
Neither of her parents speak English well, so Erica had to translate everything, including federal financial aid forms.
What's your annual gross income? Like, they didn't know what that was. They didn't know what that stood for. So like having to translate that, I don't know what annual gross income is.
Erica didn't feel comfortable going back to her high school for help. She isn't a student there anymore. But Erica does have one support system that most low-income first-generation college students do not. Breakthrough Austin.
Okay, so we have four things that we have to do, right? Mm-hmm. Essay, resume, transcript, and letter of rec.
That's Daniel Jackson, okay. A counselor at Breakthrough. The nonprofit helps first-generation college students starting as early as sixth grade. They provide summer classes and help with college applications. The goal is to help these students get their degree. Jackson is Erica's counselor. He says financial aid is one of a dozen things students must do to prepare for college. Sign up for housing, register for classes, buy textbooks, go to orientation, fill out medical papers.
It's the accumulation of these tiny things that all on top of one another make it feel overwhelming for someone. That's kind of our role, to help it feel more manageable.
In early July, Jackson tells Erica she can appeal her financial aid package and ask Our Lady of the Lake for more money. Jackson is pushing for her to attend a four-year college.
It is a game changer in her life that can make potentially all the difference in the world.
The chances of Erica making it to sophomore year increase by 25% at a four-year college versus a two-year college.
She'll be living on campus. She'll be fully engaged in school. She'll be well taken care of by that small, caring environment. She'll have a lot of contact with professors. Is that possible at ACC? Absolutely. Are there small classes at ACC? Yes, but it won't be the same experience. She'll be living at home.
Plus, Erica's not as excited about going to ACC. At one point, she says she worries she won't make it to class if she went there. But the appeal process takes time. By late July, Erica still doesn't know where she's going to school.
I'm feeling really stressed because, oh my God, August is here and school starts in like 3 weeks and I don't know where I'm living. I don't know what school I'm going to.
Even with Breakthrough's help, Erica still feels stressed that her parents can't help.
I don't want to say they don't care, but it's not like their priority because they know either way I'll probably end up at college this fall. However, like it makes me particularly feel like I have to make my own decisions now. Like my life depends on a decision that I make and I have no parent guidance to it. It makes me feel kind of alone.
But her mom and younger sister are there a few weeks later, in mid-August, when Jackson sits them down at Breakthrough to make a final decision. Our Lady gave Erica another $4,000, and she negotiated for cheaper housing, but she'll still need to take out loans.
It is possible that you will graduate with over $20,000 in debt.
So here's the question Erica has to answer. Is that debt worth it if it means going to a four-year college and living on campus? Erica says yes.
What I'm hearing is that this is your preferred choice. That's what I'm hearing.
Yep.
Jackson turns to Erica's mom and asks what she thinks. What she decides is good, Erica's mom replies.
I feel like bells should whistle or something. We should have a ceremony, like pop the champagne or something.
But Erica doesn't have a lot of time to celebrate. Classes start in 2 weeks. August 28th, move-in day. Erica is walking down a long hallway with a few boxes and a suitcase. She's trying to find her dorm room.
Oh, this one right here.
There we go.
There's a cutout fish on her door made of construction paper with her name on it.
Way bigger than I expected it to be.
Yeah.
By getting to college, Erica has cleared a major hurdle. But Jackson says there's still more ahead.
This is an adventure for her. This is outside of her comfort zone. She does not know people there. And finances continue to be a concern. She's very close with her family. How will she feel being away from home? Will she feel comfortable at the school?
How I'm feeling right now? I feel really, I don't want to say like guilty, but there's like a part of me that I feel like maybe I should have stayed at home because like seeing my mom and my sister kind of break down in front of me. However, that's kind of like 30% of my emotions right now. 70% of them are just like, I'm so glad to be out of the home and I'm ready to begin a new journey, a new chapter in my life.
Erica's been at school for a little more than a week. She says it's already starting to feel like home. Kate McGee, KUT News.
This was just one of several stories in the series, plus a Tumblr blog we set up to track the students. You can find all that at themonthsbetween.kut.org. The family of Sandra Bland is suing multiple people over the arrest and subsequent death of Sandra Bland in the Waller County Jail in July. That includes the Department of Public Safety and DPS trooper Brian Encinia. But the state says those two lawsuits should be dismissed because of immunity. KUT's Ben Philpott explains.
Let's start with the argument that the Department of Public Safety is immune from the lawsuit. That comes from the 11th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which very clearly grants immunity to states and state agencies. Ranjana Natarajan is the director of the Civil Rights Clinic at the University of Texas School of Law. She says that immunity has been pretty well established.
But it has no impact whatsoever on the claims against the individual officers, and it has no impact on the claims against the county.
The second immunity involves one of those individual officers. DPS trooper Brian Encinia pulled Bland over for failing to signal before changing lanes. That stop led to a physical altercation and Bland's arrest. The request for dismissal argues Encinia is entitled to qualified immunity, which means for the suit to continue, the court would need to find that Ms. Bland's rights were violated.
the question would be probably, did Officer Insignia violate Ms. Bland's rights by using excessive force against her or unlawfully arresting her? And did that violation, was that violation clearly established at the time of the incident?
Insignia's lawyers also argue that the suit does not clearly explain what constitutional violations occurred and that they can't mount a defense unless they are given those specifics. But again, no matter what happens with these dismissal motions, suits against workers at the Waller County Jail will not be affected. Ben Philpott, KUT News.
Some of the housing built for people who are homeless in Austin comes from programs funded by HUD, which is the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Over the summer, a HUD official raised the possibility of withholding that funding to push cities to reevaluate policies that target the homeless. So as KUT's Joy Diaz tells us, HUD Secretary Julian Castro was in Austin this week, and he talked about how HUD might just start withholding funds.
It's not like Austin's Housing Authority is misusing funds intended for people who are homeless. What's happening is that the U.S. Department of Justice said in a brief last month that criminalizing people who are homeless is unconstitutional. The DOJ argues that's because it criminalizes their condition, not their behavior. Along those lines, people with criminal records do not qualify for government-subsidized housing. Here's HUD Secretary Julian Castro.
I do believe that the Justice Department has made a very good point about the criminalization of homelessness. And my hope is that more and more cities out there that are criminalizing homelessness, in effect, will take a second look, will reexamine their policies and improve them.
Austin is one of those cities. The city's No Sit, No Lie ordinance tickets people who sleep on the street or who sit on public benches for more than 30 minutes around the downtown area. Austin Mayor Steve Adler says the ordinance is not the problem.
Ultimately, what we need to be focused on, what this council needs to focus on, because it is truly the core of the issue, it is the answer to solving the problem and not just addressing the symptom, is to focus on getting people homes.
Something easier said than done. According to the city's latest report on homelessness, almost 2,000 people live in Austin's streets. Joy Diaz, KUT News.
I don't know how much driving you've done this summer, but it is a lot cheaper to be driving than it was this time last year. I mean, gas costs way less, and it's all because crude oil prices are down. Checking WTI crude right now, it's around $45 a barrel. Gas is averaging somewhere around $2.20 a gallon. Great if you're driving, but you know, there's a ripple effect of this oil downturn in Texas, and it's obvious if you do business in towns like Alice. But as KUT's Mose Bushell reports for State Impact Texas, there's one business that's going through a boom right now, the repo man.
Ryan Peck says some jobs are harder than others when you're a repo man.
If there's kids involved, this is tough because you know the kids are doing without. So, you know, I just get the job done. I try to be as nice and polite about it as possible. But yeah, sometimes it is tough.
Lately, he's been busy. To see why, we took a walk around his impound lot on the south side of Corpus Christi.
We just got a few pickup trucks, a couple brand new trucks, 2015s, a couple work trucks. These are all vehicles that are not getting redeemed, that are fixing to go to the auction.
It's a lot of trucks. That's caught Peck's attention.
In our business, there's trucks that we normally don't pick up. You know, those three-quarter ton diesel trucks, one-ton trucks.
They're pickup trucks tricked out with suspension lifts, good stereos, rims, work trucks that are also status symbols for the, well, mostly guys that drive them.
They're going to pay those bills before they pay anything else. And we're now seeing that those trucks are getting picked up.
So, where are they coming from?
Actually, this truck right here, if you want to look in the back of it, it's got tons of oil field equipment, you know, tools and wrenches and things like that that they would use in the oil field.
He says during the drilling boom, oil workers bought a lot of these expensive trucks. Now the boom's over and they can't make payments. So he's doing a lot of repossessions in the nearby oil town of Alice.
Alice would be probably my first stop to find out what's going on, what's about to happen.
All right, I'll do that.
There are streets in Alice that remind you what the town's all about. They have names like Energy Avenue and Industrial Boulevard. These are where big oil field service companies like Halliburton brought jobs during the boom. When the bust came to Alice, the ones hit hardest were the oil field workers.
Basically, they tell you there's no work right now, and we'll call you when we need you.
It's been over 3 months since Javier Gámez heard those words. I met him at a local food pantry. He says he used to make up to $6,000 a month as a derrick man. Now he's lucky to pull in $600 doing construction work.
So that's how it goes. Like I said, you're accustomed to getting pretty good money, and you have a nice truck, and you have a nice home, and you have to start downgrading, letting things go.
Yeah, he bought a truck. He doesn't have it anymore. He says a lot of his buddies lost their trucks. They ignored the warnings of old-timers who lived through the booms and busts before.
They tell us, you know, you need to prepare, you need to save, you need to save. And us being young, we're like, heck, I'm buying a new truck. You know, I can afford it. And they're like, don't do it. And us being young and pretty much not dumb, but unprepared, we do it.
It might sound short-sighted, but a lot of people thought the good times would last. Even a lot of local governments are grappling with the big drop in tax revenue.
That snowball effect happens where we don't have any money because we're not working, so we don't go spend at the restaurant. So now the poor lady at the restaurant loses hours, so it just goes down the line.
All the way back to the car dealership.
My name is Jacob Lopez. I'm the owner of Coyote Auto Sales in Alice, Texas.
Sitting at his desk beneath a rumbling AC unit, Lopez remembers when the trucks used to fly off the lot.
70% of my business was heavy-duty trucks, lifted, diesel 4x4, and now I just don't have that demand anymore.
In other parts of the country, low gas prices are encouraging people to buy bigger vehicles. Not here. Lopez says he sells more affordable, fuel-efficient cars, but really, most people aren't buying any cars at all.
I saw the business drop off after the spring when you started seeing the rigs being shut down and stuff.
And that reminded me of something Ryan Peck, the repo man, mentioned back in Corpus Christi. He said, if the downturn keeps up, car loans will be harder to get. Fewer people will buy cars, so fewer people will default on their loans. And that means eventually his business will take a hit.
If nobody's paying for cars, nobody's buying cars as well.
So in a way, you got to watch out for that same cycle.
Yeah, it comes back to get everybody. You know, nobody's safe from it.
But don't worry about Peck. He says he's saving his money in case the repo bubble becomes a repo bust. Reporting on energy and the environment for State Impact Texas, I'm Mose Bouchard, KUT News.
It's been more than a couple weeks since two TV journalists in Virginia were killed live on television, and it's led some people to ask whether workplaces could be better prepared for those kinds of scenarios. So what could employers do? KUT's Jasmine Garson reports.
Don Greenwood is a former police officer. He's now a security management consultant in Houston. Many of the trainings he offers are about prevention. Greenwood encourages managers to be observant.
To act and act quickly, to intervene, and not to let things fester and boil and boil and boil within the company.
But he says managers also have to get their employees on board.
The most important part of training is to get employees to feel that there's a culture in the company that makes it possible and makes it okay for them to come forward and report things of concern.
A big criticism of this approach is whether it creates a culture of distrust among employees. After all, everyone has a bad day, right? But Greenwood says managers should be looking broader. Check for patterns.
One of the very big clues is, what is the person saying? What are they saying themselves? Because a lot of these people who are moving in the direction of a violent outbreak try and tip others off in order to build some interest in what they're doing.
So what if a shooting actually happens?
The three steps are to get out, to hide out, and then to fight or to take out.
He says that the first thing is to just keep running and don't look back.
If there's no path of escape, then I've got to hide. And then the third step is if the shooter was to discover the hiding place, they need to attack the shooter and survive as best they can.
But Greenwood also says the bulk of workplace shootings aren't happening in offices.
Deaths of police officers on the job and firefighters is a big part of that workplace violence statistic. Healthcare workers. And also murders committed in robberies of convenience stores and liquor stores and gas stations.
Lock myself in the back office and call 911.
That's what Jacqueline Arad was taught.
I worked in Memphis, Tennessee at a gas station, and they trained us on what to do in case of a shooter and also how to prevent it.
She says the prevention tips she got at the gas station, keeping the windows clean so outsiders could see what was happening, having a good relationship with the police, didn't make her feel much safer. Arad is now a teacher, and she's received two different trainings at two different school districts.
Here in Austin, they taught us to lock the doors, but we don't hide here. They want the kids to be able to fight if they need to.
Don Greenwood says that's pretty standard. Emergency procedures used to be about ducking under a desk and hiding. But when school shootings started happening, hiding made people easy targets. But in most cases, it comes back to those three steps: run, hide, and if you have to, fight.
So these are hard things to talk about in an audience of, you know, employees from all backgrounds. But that's really the fundamentals of an in-progress situation, and it's the basis for most of the training that's being done.
Do you ever have these moments of reflection in which you say, I can't believe this is what we're coming to?
Yes, all the time.
But Greenwood says it's important to keep things in perspective.
Probably last weekend, there were more kids killed in Chicago in gang violence on one weekend than are killed in office workplace violence situations in an entire year.
Jasmine Garst, KUT News.
The wine that we might pour into a glass in a few months is currently being harvested as grapes from Texas vineyards, and we had some kind of unusual weather this year. So what does that mean for the Texas wine industry and for the 2015 wines we might soon see on store shelves? Joining us to talk about that is Texas Monthly drinks columnist Jessica Dupuy. Thank you for coming in, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.
What is the grape harvest looking like this year for Texas vineyards?
Well, overall, it's looking really great. We have a couple of different regions to pay attention to, but in the High Plains, where the majority of Texas grapes come from, it looks like it's going to be high in quantity and high in quality. In the Hill Country, quantity is going to be a little bit lacking. We're still going to have a good crop, but quality is going to be really great.
Right. And we had a ton of rain in the spring, Memorial Day flooding, disastrous rain in many cases. And then it was dry, 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 hot weather. Is that a good thing for the vineyards?
Actually, not really.
Okay.
You know, we had four solid weeks of rain in May. And while it's nice to get some rain in the spring, in the late spring and early summer, we had torrential rains, as we all probably remember. And so what happens, and particularly what happened in the Hill Country with vineyards, is a lot of that wetness and humidity can form fungus on the grapes. And so vineyard managers have to be extremely meticulous with their vines, meaning that they have to thin out the foliage, the leaves that grow and basically hang over the grapes, because if it stays wet under there, fungus becomes a big problem. Yeah.
Okay, well, what is the harvest going to mean for what we see on store shelves?
So in generality, you know, overall, we're going to see some really great wines come for the 2015 vintage. Keep in mind that we're going to see probably the white wines first because they take less time to age and get in bottle, whereas the red wines are going to take a little bit of time in barrel. And so we probably won't see a lot of those released until, you know, a year or two from now, depending on what kind of grape it is. But remember that for 2013 and 2014, we had some late spring freezes in the High Plains and in the Hill Country, which really, really was detrimental for white wines in Texas. It means that we didn't have a lot to work with, and the quality may have been good in what we were able to get, but it was so little, like just a fraction of what we've been able to get on an average basis. So what's making people happy this year in terms of winemakers and grape growers is that the white grapes have come back. We didn't have any late spring freezes to mess things up. So we're able to have, I think, what'll be great on the shelves anyway is a proliferation of really great white wines and also red wines, but to really fill the shelves and for Texans to look forward to throughout the year.
I know you talk to a lot of producers. Are there any specific wines to look forward to in the 2015 vintage? Did I say that right?
Sure, yeah. So, you know, first of all, there are going to be a lot. So it's hard to pick just a few,
okay.
But you know, some of the information I've gotten so far, the Bingham Family Vineyards, they pick in the High Plains and they have a few hundred acres of vineyards. And one of the things that they've become known for is Trebbiano and Vermentino.
And what kind of wines are those?
So Vermentino and Trebbiano are both white grapes that are originally from Italy. The Trebbiano in particular, from what I've heard from Dave Riley, who's the winemaker at Dukeman Family Winery, is going to be sensational this year. And he's something he's really looking forward to the most. Another thing is out at the Salt Lick, which we all know for barbecue. Mm-hmm. They also have quite a few vineyards out there. And they have a Tempranillo that they have been, I guess, cultivating for quite a few years now. And most of those grapes go towards Fall Creek Vineyards. Apparently, the grapes for 2015 are some of the best that they have ever seen. And so if you're a Tempranillo fan, the 2015 Fall Creek is something to look forward to.
And Tempranillo again.
So Tempranillo is a grape from Spain. It's probably the most predominant grape you'll find there. And we're used to seeing the term Rioja or Ribera del Duero on labels from Spain. That's a big indicator that it's a Tempranillo grape. And it's a really strong grape for Texas. I'm not sure it's the shining star, but it's a good one.
So Texas Wine Month is in October, right?
Correct.
Now, if I go out to the Hill Country and tour some wineries, am I going to see all these grapes on the vine?
No, you won't. Or you might see a few at the beginning of October. But in general, because Texas has such a hot climate, our growing season is different than what you might find in California or other cooler areas of the world. So we're primarily picking in the heat of August. I mean, we have people going as early as the first week of August to start picking. And that's both in the High Plains and the Hill Country.
Jessica Dupuy is a drinks columnist for Texas Monthly. You can look for her harvest report in the coming weeks at texasmonthly.com. Thanks for your time, Jessica.
Thank you.
That is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of September. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe to it at weekend.kut.org. Send any questions or comments you might have to me, nathan@kut.org. You can also email us at news@kut.org. I'm @KUTNathan on Twitter. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks again for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. Oh,